Chapter 9, which tells of Captain Prometheus Bound. Quote, "It seemed to me that the garden was infinitely saturated with invisible persons." Jorge Luis Borges, from his short story, The Garden of Forking Paths. "High up in the north, in the land called Svithshod, there stands a rock. It is 100 miles high and 100 miles wide. Every 1,000 years, a little bird comes to this rock to sharpen its beak. When the rock has thus been worn away, a single day of eternity will have passed." "What was that?" said Harvey.
"What was what?" said Mahogany.
"That noise, it sounded like scraping to my ears."
"Oh," said Mahogany, "that was just a little bird from The Story of Mankind come to sharpen his beak on your head."
The narrator intervenes here. "Oh, ancient teller of tales, magician of time without time and shape upon shape, what mystery is this you implore us to believe?" "It is a little known fact, discovered, in truth, by Captain Harvey, that the exact imitation of any shape in the history of time takes the imitator back to the time of the original holder of that shape. Which is to say, the exact imitation of any shape in the history of time takes the imitator back to the time of the original holder of that shape." Footnote. "The exact imitation of any shape in the history of time takes the imitator back to the time of the original holder of that shape." Exempli gratia. "If a man were to occupy the exact shape and space that Napoleon occupied when receiving his coronation, he would immediately return to that time. As soon as he or Napoleon moved, and the two no longer occupied the same space, the imitator would return to his own time. This type of travel occurs with great regularity, but rarely for more than an instant. A normal person can only imitate another person, and as soon as the two cease to make identical movements, they are separated and the imitator returns to his original time. It is this instantaneous travel that leads people to believe they have lived in other ages. We have all had the experience of being in an ancient ruin or castle and believing we were actually alive in that place hundreds or thousands of years before. That is because we were alive then, though only for the space of a second." Harvey, blessed with his special illness, was not subject to the limitations of normal men, and could occupy not only the time-space of people, but of all other creatures and objects as well. It so happened, then, that when Harvey sat to contemplate his antiquity, he fell into the exact shape of a rough-hewn rock that had jutted out over the Mediterranean more than 1,000,000 years before. As the rock did not move, Harvey could relive the time of the stone as long as he did not move. And, having taken on the same space as the stone, he took on its personality and felt no inclination to move. Consequently, Harvey remained there for 1,000,000 years. The first centuries were slow. Man had not evolved, and few animals ventured out to the inhospitable crag. The changing sea and sky were Harvey's only companions, and he attempted to memorize the infinite variety of clouds and colors. He had his friend Sisyphus, the wave, who crashed ever faithfully at his feet, and a small bird who visited once every 1,000 years, sharpening his beak on the captain's head. Time passed. Days followed nights, followed days, followed nights. Rain conquered sun, conquered rain, conquered sun. Gradually, inevitably, Harvey began to erode.
First his head was sharpened into a cone, then his hands dissolved into his knees, then Sisyphus devoured his toes. As he thus disintegrated, he witnessed the history of Capmathan. The first human he met was an ape-like creature, later known as Grimaldi Man, who scurried onto his back and paused for a moment to watch the setting sun. 27,000 years later, a group of men and women, known as Ligurians, arrived from the west. Short and stocky in limb, they carved their settlements into the primitive rocks and eked out a meager existence until the first Romans crossed the Alps and engaged them in war. Then the action became continuous. There were brutal battles at Portus Herculis Monachi as the Romans opened land communication with their Iberian conquests. In B.C. 12, Augustus celebrated the completion of his Via Julia Augusta with a wine-soaked orgy at Roquebrune, and 32 years later, Harvey heard the first mention of Jesus Christ. The years continued to pass, and the world around him changed with ever-increasing speed. In 1243, the castle was completed at Roquebrune. In 1345 and 1467, the area was decimated by the plague. Footnote. Decimated is indeed the word. During the years 1345 to 1349, 90% of the population of Western Europe fell victim to the epidemic. L. H. Young, in his fascinating book Remarkable Events in the World's History, Porter and Coates, Philadelphia, 1893, pages 11 through 16, writes, "The plague appears to have stayed 5 or 6 months in one place, and then to have gone in search of fresh victims. Its symptoms are minutely described by many writers. It generally appeared in the groin, or under the armpits, where swellings were produced which broke into sores, attended with fever, spitting, and vomiting of blood. The patient frequently died in half a day, within 2 days at the most. The pestilence arose in China, Tartary, India, and Egypt about the year 1345, and in a report made to the Pope at Avignon, it is recorded that it swept away 23,800,000 persons throughout the East in the course of a single year. It spread to Greece, Italy, and Western Europe, and in Germany alone its ravages were estimated at 12,400,000, over 1,500 of whom were reported to have died within 4 hours at Lübeck. The terrible visitation was everywhere attended by a total dissolution of the bonds of society. Parents forsook their children, wives their husbands, and physicians would not make visits. The last dregs of the calamity were drained by that unfortunate race, the Jews, as a belief spread over several countries that they had produced the pestilence by poisoning the wells and fountains, and in many places they were massacred in the thousands by the infuriated populace. In several parts of Germany, where this persecution chiefly raged, the Jews were literally exterminated. 12,000 of them were murdered in the single city of Mentz." Back to the text. In 1504, Michelangelo journeyed up the coast from Carrara and spent an afternoon writing verses at Harvey's feet. In 1848, Montone broke from Monaco, and Prince Charles III constructed the casino to finance his loss of income and christened the rocky shelf of Les Peluges as Monte Carlo. 20 years later, the railroad arrived from Nice with the first swarms of tourists. A man named Charles Wells, who looked remarkably like Harvey, broke the bank at the casino, and the captain vowed he would one day do the same. In 1902, Dr. Guglielminetti laid the first tarred road in the world connecting Nice to Montone. And during the wars, Harvey saw endless migrations of men pass there. In 1965, a famous architect, Le Corbusier, drowned beneath the powerful tongue of Sisyphus. And in 1979, the sea rose in anger at the construction in Antibes and flooded the town with a 40-foot wave. Finally, Harvey witnessed the years between 1993 and 2013. Years of greed, egotism, and overpopulation, in which more natural beauty was destroyed than had been in the previous 20,000. When he was almost worn to his last grain of existence, Harvey reached the time from which he had departed. He saw himself walk out again to the rock, and was about to sit down and repeat the same million years, when Sisyphus, the wave, tired of the captain's company, hit him in the face and sent him reeling backwards and kept him in the time-space of the present. Mahogany met him at a point halfway around the cape. The remainder of the walk, though not as beautiful as it had been many years before, was still lovely. The footpath continued beneath the cool shadows of the olive trees and pines, brushing alongside the rocks, passing the clumps of cypress and mimosa, and ducking through small tunnels chiseled in the stone. It opened in spots, dipping near the water and into the spray, then hurried back to the security of the trees. Slipping through the leaves in tears, the sun fell like an illuminated fountain from leaf to leaf, bathing the earth in a glow of green. They walked without effort, carried by the breeze, until the path left the shore and ascended to the moyenne corniche that led to Monaco. When they reached the shoulder of the road, one of the men Mahogany had met playing boule drove up in a 57 Triumph No. 3 convertible. He stopped to offer them a ride. "Où est-ce qu'on va?" he asked. "À Antibes," replied Harvey, taking on the man's personality. "Moi aussi," he exclaimed. Remembering that Mahogany spoke no French, the man switched to English. "Come, I've got business in Antibes. You'll find it's a lovely town, despite its history of catering to the money-stained rich." The journey along the coast was no less beautiful in the car than it had been on the train. It was certainly more exciting, for Harvey had assimilated the old man's character and had convinced the gentleman to let him take the wheel. Claude, which was the Frenchman's name, had been a chauffeur in his youth, employed at one of the villas in the hills above Menton. After work, his employer had often let him take the TR3 for a ride up the coast, and he had learned every inch of the road from Menton to Cannes. He swore that one day he, too, would own a TR3, and, as fortune would have it, he did, for he had an affair with the daughter of his employer, and she persuaded her father to give him the car. Although Claude was reluctant to let Harvey drive, he became so enchanted with the captain's old-world charm that, amazed as he was, he consented after little debate. Claude's first sense of amazement was nothing compared to what he felt once Harvey took the wheel. It was uncanny. It was as if the captain had driven that road every day of his life. He knew each curve and slope, and accelerated around the blind corners. In Harvey's hands, the man and machine were one. The road and machine were one. The man and machine and motion were one. The automobile rode consistently on the outer edges of the tires, balancing perfectly the momentum and weight of the car against the pull of the turns. Though it longed to squeal, the rubber never spoke nor slipped, keeping constant contact with the road. Claude was in heaven, and he closed his eyes to better enjoy the motion that was engraved in every fiber of his soul. Mahogany sat in the back with his head thrown to the wind, drinking the shower of sun that splashed off the cliffs and dived into the sea. Mahogany was ashamed to think that, until that time, he had considered a BMW to be an acceptable car. To the disappointment of all three, they reached Antibes in no time. Claude told them to meet him at 6 for the ride home. Then he went to find his associates. Left to themselves, Harvey and Mahogany wandered down to the harbor. They saw a sign that read, "Musée Picasso," and decided to go in.